You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll have some fun talking about insects and education in sciences with the Milwaukee man known as the Bug Whisperer. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. A Democratic primary debate in the governor's race has been canceled after its format was criticized. A Wendy's restaurant in the Wausau area got statewide attention after staff walked off the job, citing low pay and staffing. And the Athens High School baseball team is making an emotional trip to the state tournament. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks.
Let's start with this debate over a debate. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association decided yesterday to cancel this primary debate between Democratic candidates after a backlash. A little disclaimer, Wisconsin Public Radio is a member of the Broadcasters Association, but was not involved in decisions about this debate. So talk us through this story. What were people upset about with these debate plans?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, the basic problem is that there are 11 Democratic candidates for governor. And so from the point of view of the Broadcasters Association, that is hard to, you know, that is a circus. That is, it's hard to run a debate with that many candidates. So their idea was to limit it to the top four candidates, according to the Marquette poll. And that's who got to do it. Now, that leaves out a whole bunch of candidates, and there's a bit of a question about, you know, how much people are dialed in. Is that unfair to candidates that people don't necessarily know their names, but maybe they would like them if they heard from them? And so that was the source of this controversy.
Right. We've been seeing pushback from candidates to that plan, I think from the Democratic Party at some point, and Marquette Law School poll director Charles Franklin said, well, with margin of errors and things like that, this poll isn't the best thing to be used as a metric. So a lot of unhappiness about this original plan.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. You have to sympathize with the broadcasters in a way. I mean, it's just because they are trying to solve a legitimate problem of how to have a debate with so many candidates. If you watch the debates in the 2016 Republican presidential primary, you saw that those debates were like, they were, you know, it was a lot of like, all right, candidates, raise your hand if you support this or that. It's not like the most edifying thing. On the other hand, to go, you know, to leave out so many from a race is, you know, it's understandable that people push back or had gripes about that. I think it is notable that as you say, the complaints were not just coming from obviously less popular candidates. It was sort of a broadly shared sense that this was not the right solution. And you know, in a primary, because candidates like agree on a lot of stuff, just naturally because they're part of the same party, it does mean that voters' preferences can shift all over the place and move very quickly. So, you know, there's something to the complaint that that it would have left off the stage people who really deserve a hearing.
And politically, this is a challenge for the candidates themselves. They are in this crowded field, as you say, with a lot of points they agree on more than they disagree. It's hard for any particular candidate to stand out. This debate might or might not have been an opportunity to emerge from the field, I guess.
Right. Well, I mean, no disrespect to anyone when I say that it's not like these debates are going to be watched by millions and millions of people in any event. You know, that it's not like in a presidential race or something. But what it is a place where it's, you know, where there's an opportunity for candidates to make a little news, to you know, people can go off their script and say something that is revealing. So, I mean, it's definitely a useful part of an election process. And in the absence of debates like this, what really happens is it favors the candidates who have the most money and can pay for advertising and other ways of getting their message out. If you don't have the money, that's not open to you.
Talking to Rob Menser from USA Today Network Wisconsin, rounding up some of the top stories from around the state this week. Rob, there's been issues with protests at fast food restaurants on and off in the state and elsewhere, people calling for higher wages. Something a little different caught statewide attention at a Wendy's not far from you. Tell us the story.
Right, yes. So at the Wendy's restaurant in Weston, which is a part of, you know, the Wausau area, 7 employees walked out and closed down the store. It has since reopened, and at least some of those employees have found other jobs already. But they're speaking out about what they say were intolerable conditions and low pay at this store. So in a way, this is like a local story about one business, but it also connects to a bunch of broader issues too.
Yeah, and they were citing, talk about the conditions they were citing, very long schedules, long shifts, many of them in a row. Talk about what they cited, and they put up a sign, I gather, when they shut down the shop.
Right. Well, I mean, the main thing was they were understaffed, and so as a result, employees were working 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week, so 2 weeks in a row, maybe, they'd be working every day, because, it was as hard to keep the restaurant going without the workers there. At high traffic times, they, according to these employees, they would have maybe like 3 people in the store when they should have 8 or 11, many more. And so this, as you can imagine, creates a bunch of pressure on those employees.
And I understand the employees who had walked out are being contacted by that movement for that $15 minimum wage that's been trying to reach out to fast food workers.
Right. And so it's one of the ways that this story connects to these broader issues. One of them is just simply like the economy being, this is a relatively low wage job in the best of cases. And so at a time of very low unemployment, it's really hard to get people into these jobs. That's what the management is finding. And yes, indeed, this was not before the walkout, but after the walkout, they were contacted by the labor organizing group Fight for 15. These employees, they're not specifically asking for $15 an hour, but as part of a sort of broader labor movement, for sure, it connects.
And lastly, Rob, you pointed out to us a bittersweet story in the high school sports world. The Athens High School baseball team won their 2 sectional games. They made it to the Division IV state tournament. But this came after the loss of one of their teammates just days before. Tell us about that story.
Right, yes. A student named Tucker Westfall died on Saturday. He was 15, in a crash of a utility vehicle on his farm that belonged to his relative. And then on Tuesday, his baseball team, including his father, Dale Westfall, is an assistant coach on the team, played there in their sectionals and they had a couple of their best games of the year, and amid it all, emotional scenes, tears and hugs throughout, and sort of the support of that community for this father who lost his son.
Yeah, talk about kind of the attitude of the team with this loss behind them, and I guess inspired in a way to play some of their best games, as you said.
Right, no question. I mean, this is Athens is this small town out in north central Wisconsin, a very rural area, and just a very close-knit community. Any team would be affected by this, but it is just very much the case that the people in that community feel connected with their neighbors and their friends. Is just that kind of place. And so I do think that that team had a sense of purpose, a sense of connection after losing their teammate, and it's horribly sad, but it was a moment when they came together as well.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
All right, thank you.
That's Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He was with us for our weekly checkup on news from around the state. Where science and entertainment meet, that's where you'll find our next guest. Tony Gustine is an entomologist from Milwaukee who years ago came up with the idea of a traveling bug show called the Creepy Crawly Zoo. He lets kids interact with hissing cockroaches, giant African millipedes, stink beetles, and other kinds of insects. And the kids love it, and more importantly to him, they become curious about science. Now he wants to launch what he describes as sort of a science theme park in Waukesha, the Gateway Science Center. Tony's in the studio, and some of the stars of the Creepy Crawly Zoo are here, too. Tony, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Well, I want to meet some of these guys, but I want to spend some time on the project first. What got you into this idea of bringing the Creepy Crawly Zoo to schools and other institutions?
It started as a joke over a couple beers in college.
as all good things do.
A few blocks from here, actually. The conversation evolved to the point where we said, can you imagine if you went to schools and you brought live insects that kids could touch and feel, what that would have done to kids like us? And we all were like, yeah, and toasting. And I was kind of like, yeah, why isn't somebody doing that? I mean, that would have saved me four majors. And I started making phone calls. And the next thing you know, I'm on a tidal wave of demand that I couldn't get off of. And I've spent the last 20 years of my life doing this.
And your hope is that kids get inspired to be interested not just in insects and other creepy crawlies, but science in general, right?
Yeah, it was kind of weird because I've learned from what I've been doing, going to schools, and I saw what was happening, but I didn't really realize what it was I was doing. But I light them on fire. I mean, that's my job. I want to do this in a way that would be done if I was sitting where they are. And I have parents and teachers telling me years later, their kids are still talking about it. I have grown people coming to my shows with their kids because I went to their school. And some of them most of them have some kind of pet tarantula, scorpions. It just was something that really carried on. And I started to realize that I was doing something more than I thought. And so with insects are everywhere. And I was greatly influenced by the Redux of Cosmos, where they talked about the stories of all these different scientists who were in social conditions where if they hadn't had a little tiny stroke of luck, they would have never grown into the people that they had become. And the discoveries they made changed all of the human race. So go on.
You've got a handful of tanks here, and again, we'll meet the critters in a bit. But what happens? You're in a school, say, or a library. You've got all these creatures with you, and what happens?
Well, I do a shtick. It's not information. It's a wave of excitement that I'm trying to create. So I make them laugh, I make them scream, and I give them instructions on what we're about to do with the live animals, and I let them be responsible for the safety of my animals, and they get to come up and take out and hold some of these different things that I've brought with me today.
Yeah, so let's meet the one right on the other side of this computer screen from me with an open lid. It's an open lid.
What we have here is a very horny male millipede who is bothering the female at the moment. This is the African millipede. It is a little bit larger than the local ones that we find around here.
Right. This is like a tank, kind of. This is heavy duty.
Yeah.
Is the millipede, is this technically an insect, or is this in the arthropod family, or what?
Diplopod, to be specific.
Okay.
They're all arthropods, and very good observation. I bring a lot of different animals, not just insects. Mm-hmm. In fact, I only have one insect with me today because, well, there's just a lot of interesting things out there. So this is actually one of the flagships of my show.
Am I going to hold this guy?
I think you should.
Oh, that's something.
If you panic, make sure it falls on the table.
Okay, nope. I think I'm good. I once held a tarantula on my arm for a while.
Oh, then that's nothing.
A collector had brought it in to a pet food store I worked at. Oh, he's really interested in my thumb. So this is like, what, I have to say about 5 inches long, about, just for the people that are brownish. Rings around it, just a ton of legs, just a whole lot of legs and feelers here, curiously wandering around. What's the diameter, you'd say? Half an inch?
At least a half inch, a healthy half inch.
Okay, and he's not interested in eating human flesh. I'm just going to go out on a limb.
I made sure to feed them before I got here.
Okay, good. All right, well, I'll hand him back to you. Here he goes.
Thank you.
And so how do kids, I think I did okay there, and I didn't know that I would. Give us the range of reaction from the kid holding that guy.
They lose their minds. My show is controlled chaos at the end. But I have very specific and subtle rules to keep them in check, and they tend to police each other. But no, they lose it completely. They're wide-eyed screaming maniacs running around, and they just can't get enough of it. I have a hard time getting rid of them after the show.
Talking to Tony Gustine, an entomologist from Milwaukee. He brings the Creepy Crawly Zoo of variety of creepy crawlies to schools, libraries, and elsewhere. Before we meet more of these guys, Tony, you're working on kind of having a home base now, this Gateway Science Center. Do I have the name right?
You are correct.
And so what are you working toward there?
Well, we've made major, major strides within the last year, especially recently with my association with Dan Capps, who is originally from the Madison area. He is donating his $500,000 insect collection to the project. My nonprofit status will be up soon, and I do have a lot of supporters just waiting for that, which it's a weird feeling because I've been working very hard on this for a long time, and all of a sudden now I'm in another phase of it. Never thought I'd get past the first one.
The reality is looming.
Yes, yes. It's now just a matter of time.
And so you're hoping to end up, you'll have, it'll be not a museum exactly, but a live exhibit. Well, live and dead, actually. You'll have dead insects, too.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's. I'll explain it as best I can, where it's about the experience. It's a insect reptile zoo. Where you get to do the same kinds of things you would do in my show. Touch, feel, feed the animals, interact with them. But the really important part was that I had designed an outside area that was botanically designed to attract animals, where kids could just take a net and a jar and, you know, have at it. And those experiences on their own out there, where they see something on a plant, they smell the dirt, the associations that they build and experience on their own, that's how you reinforce memory. And then it's just the questions that form naturally. They want to know more. So you might see something on a plant, then you see it on the same plant again. And then you start asking, why do I always see this insect on the same plant? And that's one example, but then there's how do they affect our food? How do they connect to this? And I have a ton of stories and not a lot of time, but it can go anywhere from astronomy to geography to Egyptian hieroglyphs, depending on where the questions take you. So
do you have a target age range that you reach out to for kids?
I would tend to say under 7th and 8th grade. Reason being is, kids change once they hit that age. So what you want to do is plant a seed early on, something that they continually relate to in a positive way. And you hope that that continues. You've planted deep enough that when they reach that certain age that everyone knows,
where you can't be enthusiastic about anything.
That's right. That's where I draw the limit on my show, too. And but one day they're going to make a decision on what they want to do with their life. And they're going to, those experiences early on will come back again. And you hope that that appreciation carries through. And what I'm really trying to promote is not science as a subject, but science as a way of thinking. I designed a book that is, for lack of a better word, a blank coloring book where they record observations of what they saw. And then teaching the tenets of science, which are very simple rules that kids can use to think through problems. Well, any kid can own that, and that can affect every aspect of their life.
I want to meet another member of your zoo here. Our producers are being our wranglers here, and they swapped him out while we've been talking. Who's this now?
We have the vinegaroon. For a second, I thought, we hadn't switched this. Here we go.
And that reaction of surprise was not, where'd it go? Okay.
All right. This one is very slow moving.
Okay. Boy, those pinchers sure look like they could do some damage.
Yeah, you might need two hands there.
Okay, I got two hands. So it looked like a kind of a beetle-looking body. Is this the insect in the group?
No, is another arachnid, but it's deceiving because it looks like it only has six legs.
Yeah.
What makes him really neat is arachnids don't have antennas, but several of them have developed elongated legs that are almost hair-like that they use like antennas. So those are actually legs.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's what threw me. It looked like six legs, two feelers, but no.
Yeah. It makes them neat. And that tail you see on the end there, they have a gland that can flick acetic acid. And vinegar is 3 to 5% acetic acid. The stuff that one will spray is 80% acetic acid.
Okay. And how do I know he's not going to spray it at me?
Well, you don't.
Okay. But. And how bad would it be if he sprayed it at me, like right now?
Well, you're wearing glasses, so that's a good first step.
Okay.
It would burn quite a bit. I've gotten sprayed on delicate skin, and I felt it for a quick second, and then it evaporates away.
All right, so not too bad.
No, it isn't. If you got it in your eyes, it might be a little worse, but you wouldn't go blind from
If I'm cutting up limes for drinks, it does always go right into my eye. So
that
I'll
would
try
be
to
worse.
Make my glasses like look at him. Okay, and this one, I could see a kid freaking out at this pretty good.
Well, that one I don't leave open, but I do let them hold. I just do the first part of taking it out.
Oh, you don't let them take them out of the thing?
No, there are certain things where that first initiation of taking them out is the hard part.
Okay, so he's really searching out my hands with those feelers now. He's getting curious about what's going on.
Yeah, it's a neat little animal. I mean, they're part of the what I do is it is kind of a roller coaster effect where they scare the kids, but they want to experience it nonetheless.
Sure.
If they see one hold it, they can't pass it up.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm going to hand him back over. Him? I keep saying him. How do we tell?
I think this one's a he.
Okay. All right. And let's see if he'll crawl back into your hand now. All right. Okay, there he goes.
Yeah,
there he's holding on pretty good there.
Yep.
There are some things in the collection that you can't handle. Scorpions, I think we've got a scorpion here today.
I didn't say we couldn't handle those.
But there are some things that are for show only in the exhibit,
yes,
right?
I do have things, but I didn't bring any of those things today.
Okay.
So everything I have, we can touch and hold if you want to.
All right, where's the scorpion? Oh, we've got it. Okay.
Right here. Man, you're good.
Wow. I didn't even notice you bringing that over. That's Bill Martin's wrangling here. Just a few moments left.
Try and do this as quickly as possible.
You can hear Michelle Good in the background. Not well pleased with what's going on here, I think it's safe to say. I'm likely to be back with some politics talk after the news.
There we go.
Okay. I'm going to have you hold him because I'm really, he's moving around fast. And one thing I don't want to happen is me drop him and then we're looking under the console for the scorpion.
Yeah,
I'll leave this one to you. Not out of any sense of cowardice or fear. Okay, maybe
no, of course not. That isn't it at all. But I brought this flashlight so you could see this.
Okay.
All true scorpions fluoresce under a black light.
Oh, cool. Okay, yeah. The scorpion, it's a small 3 inches long or so scorpion.
Yeah, this is a baby.
A baby, okay. And there's a purple black light here. And yeah, it is kind of fluorescent. I had no idea. Why is that?
It has something to do with the structure in their protein or the proteins in their exoskeleton. They will glow up to almost a year after they die also.
Well, I'd love to look at more of these guys. We're right up against the clock. Tony, thanks a lot for sharing this with us. It's been a lot of fun.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
That's Tony Gustine, entomologist from Milwaukee. He has a traveling show he takes to schools called the Creepy Crawly Zoo, and he's working toward this science theme park in Waukesha. The Gateway Science Center.
Discovery World every month.
Discovery World every month.
Correct.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. The Trump administration is reportedly planning a major reorganization of the federal government. According to Politico, the report is nearly complete and is expected to be rolled out later this month. Among other things, it would involve consolidating public assistance programs, including food stamps, and moving them to the Department of Health and Human Services. Right now, food assistance is run by the Department of Agriculture. Health and Human Services would also likely get a name change. But moving multi-billion-dollar programs and renaming agencies generally requires some kind of green light from Congress, so it's not a sure thing. Don Kettle is a professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin and academic director of the LBJ Washington Center. He used to teach at UW-Madison. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
It is great to be there with you today, Rob. It's terrific to have a chance to talk.
And you wrote about this, Don. It's a big deal and potentially a good thing, you say. Why is reorganizing these programs, especially these public assistance programs, a big deal?
In general, I'm not a huge fan of moving boxes around. Often, usually all that does is to create more confusion and just jobs for people whose job it is to design letterheads to try to talk about the new organizational structure. But this is a case where at least some of this may actually make some work, and I think here's why. We have the existing collection of programs for lower-income Americans scattered among a whole host of different agencies. And it turns out that, for example, the people who are eligible for food stamps are often the same people who are eligible for Medicaid. They're organized in two separate federal departments, and it creates a lot of extra confusion for people who have to track down where they need to go and how they need to apply. Having a single one-stop shop for people to be able to come to apply and to, for the people who manage those programs to do a better job could make much more sense, I think. So on that level, it really does make sense to think about, I think.
And you write that there's a kind of fundamental philosophical debate, a long-running one in government service programs like this. Do you divide it up by subject area so then it makes sense to have the food under the Department of Agriculture, or do you try to design it based on the population served, in which case it might make sense to do something like this, to do this reorganization?
Exactly. And this goes way back. There was a person named Luther Gulick who wrote about this back in the Roosevelt administration as they were thinking about how best to try to structure the federal government as it was the middle of the effort to try to launch the New Deal. And he argued that there really is some fundamental choices you can make. You can either, for example, the case of food stamps, it's designed to try to promote the use of food. At one point, in fact, it was really designed to try to help people consume surplus food. So it was really a food-based program. And so having it work out of agriculture made a lot of sense. Now it's fundamentally a program of public assistance to try to help people who are lower income be able to afford food. And so it's become more like a welfare program. And so it makes a lot more sense, I think, at this point to combine programs that serve the same population and the same department so that the people who are applying don't have to continue to file different applications with different agencies, hope the stuff doesn't get lost, have to supply the same information over and over and over again. It just makes it so much easier if it were all under one roof, at least administratively. And that's if, in fact, they tend to focus on those issues as the primary ones. The concern, of course, is that that may not be all that's going on here.
Talking to Don Kettle from the University of Texas at Austin about a reported plan to reorganize a lot of federal agencies, the main goal to consolidate public assistance programs, food stamps, Medicaid, a lot of other things that help low-income Americans in one department. And Don, let's follow up with what you were just saying. Some people are looking at this and saying, okay, this is a plan based on a conservative Heritage Foundation plan. It's a Republican government. Is this a backdoor plan to just cut a lot of benefits?
And the thing that has people concerned, including me at this point, is that there is also talk, in addition to bringing all the programs under one roof or one-stop shop, to change the name of the department that would administer this to bring the name welfare back in. Once upon a time, of course, we had the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and the education programs were split off of that back in 1980, and so that the idea was, well, maybe we ought to just go back to the idea of bringing welfare back in. The concern is this. The word welfare itself is so politically charged, and among conservatives, it's a kind of bell that, once it's rung, suggests that you could have a way to find a way to identify these programs and potentially cut them. The Heritage Foundation, based in Washington, really has this as an idea, and the concern is that if you bring these programs together under one roof, it makes them a big and visible target and therefore more vulnerable to cut. So the question is this: is the primary idea behind the administration's proposal to try to improve the administration of these programs and to try to make them better for the people who are receiving them, or is it to try to bring them together and to make them a bigger and more visible target so it's that much easier to cut them? And that is what we don't know quite yet at this point, but those are the two sides of the debate that is just about ready to start brewing in Washington, and which is, I think, going to be absolutely fascinating to watch in the next few weeks.
Now, aside from that issue of whether this will lead to cuts, is there also an argument to be made that, hey, we've got these separate bureaucracies that have grown up in each department, they've got this inertia of their own, we can be more efficient as a federal government by bringing these things together?
And there, I think, Rob, the answer is absolutely yes. And that's true in two respects. The first is that we really have enormous problems in bringing different related programs together and support them with the right kind of information systems, computer systems, to be able to make sure we can identify who's eligible. It is often a royal pain to have to sit there and fill the same forms out over and over again, but send them to different agencies. There are eligibility questions that end up getting duplicated. We have lots of problems of improper payments where, because we have these things scattered around, we don't manage these programs as well as we should. This is something where clearly we could do a lot better, where we have to do a lot better because we don't have a lot of extra money to spend these days. So in terms of managing the programs better, it makes a whole lot more sense, I think, to bring them under one roof. But that is assuming, as is never the case, that there's just a single goal that this structure and this proposal really has. And I think that almost everybody believes that there, as is always the case, some big political motivations going on at exactly the same time.
We're talking to Don Kettle about the Trump administration's reported plans to reorganize the federal government, which would include combining welfare programs and moving them to the Department of Health and Human Services. HHS could also get a new name in the process, as we heard. Our guest says that's a big deal. He's a professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. You can let us know your reaction to this idea at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of consolidating public assistance, welfare programs under one roof in the federal government? If you receive some of these programs, food assistance, health assistance, aid to families with dependent children, that sort of thing, what's it like navigating the system across various departments, various federal bureaucracies? Would a one-stop shop make more sense to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about President Trump's reported plan to reorganize the federal government. According to Politico, which broke the story, the soon-to-be-released report recommends combining safety net programs, renaming the Department of Health and Human Services, and some big changes at other agencies. The plan is expected to be released later this month. Don Kettle is with us, professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, academic director of the LBJ Washington Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this plan aimed at streamlining the federal government? Does consolidating public assistance programs under one roof seem like a good idea? Do you have hopes or worries about what this might mean? Do you worry that this might lead to benefit cuts, or do you think that might be a good thing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Don, let's talk a little bit about the how here. Is this something that the White House can do all by itself, or does Congress have to get in on the game?
Congress absolutely has to be part of this, and it's one of the biggest frustrations that the Trump administration has. There's so much of what it is the president wants to do that he's been frustrated in doing because it requires other people to go along. Even though the Republicans at this point control both houses of Congress, he's had a terrible time being able to get the votes to support this. And there is almost nothing more fundamental to Congress's effort to try to guard its own turf than government reorganization. We tend to think about the executive branch as the product of what the president wants to do and with the president's chief executive. We talk about that all the time. But the fact that's often hidden is that what we have in the executive branch is usually the product of congressional decisions, and they tend to follow the maps of the congressional committees on Capitol Hill. And one of the biggest things about this proposal is that the food stamp program is under the jurisdiction of the Agriculture Committee, and the Health and Human Service programs are under jurisdiction of a couple of other committees. And so when you start moving these boxes around, immediately what you're doing is you're talking about taking power away from members of Congress. And it's especially a big issue here because food stamps are by far the biggest program in the Department of Agriculture. So you're talking about gutting a big part of the power that the agriculture committees on Capitol Hill have. So if you want to get a really good battle going in Washington, talk about trying to take power away from members of Congress, especially committee chairs. And that's just what this proposal would do. So this one is a really nasty battle down the road that's just getting ready to explode. And it's going to frustrate Donald Trump to no end, because what he most wants to do, he's going to discover yet again he can't do on his own.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Green Bay. Andrew, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Andrew?
I had a concern that this program or proposal will make administering these individual programs much harder, because each individual that's administering it is going to have to know the procedures of every single agency and program. It's going to take a master's degree to know how to get these to work.
Andrew, thanks for the call. So, yeah, Don, agencies administering these different programs already have it down. Presumably, this will be a learning curve trying to do it all in the same place.
It will. And one of the things that often is the problem is when you move the boxes, it does bring that learning curve along. And just look at what's happened to the Department of Homeland Security and how hard that's been. We still have many years to go to try to get that right. But here's a case where when it comes to food stamps and Medicaid and welfare and other kind of food and medical assistance programs, that having things under one roof I think could make real sense, because the real savings that are possible and the real efficiencies that are possible And the real administrative pieces that are possible have to do with connecting all these programs up electronically through data systems that can talk to each other. And that's the enormous potential that there is here. We've seen the difficulty, for example, with the VA and the Department of Defense trying to make sure that people who are eligible for VA benefits have data systems that talk to the systems over in the Pentagon that make them eligible. We've had terrible times making that happen, and some of those same kinds of things flow over on the domestic side when it comes to programs for public assistance. So that's the advantage. It's finding a way to make government a lot smarter and a lot faster by connecting it better through better information technology. That's the big advantage of being able to do that. And there are tremendous economies of scale that are possible, assuming that, in fact, we invest in the right people and the right systems that make government smart enough to do it. And that, unfortunately, turns out to be a much bigger problem than is often realized. And we often only find that out much later down the line.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about managing this, Don. We've talked to Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution about presidential leadership. She's criticized Presidents Obama and George W. Bush for focusing on messaging more than management. She's worried about the Trump administration's ability to manage changes like this. This would be a huge undertaking. Does the Trump administration have the skill to manage a change like this?
Right now, it's hard to imagine that any one administration in particular would find this an easy thing for a couple reasons. The first is that there are 34 different programs out there that the Government Accountability Office calls the high-risk programs. These are programs most prone to fraud, waste, abuse, and mismanagement. And we're literally losing hundreds of billions of dollars a year because we haven't invested in the right management system. So that's one part of the problem. Second is getting the people problem solved. And we have a tough time in government right now hiring the people we need to get the government's work done. And the biggest problem that we've got in the system we're talking about changing here is making sure that we got enough of the smart people and the right skills in the right places at the right time to get the job done. And we are crippling ourselves by not focusing on that. And the last piece is information technology, which at the one hand is the biggest opportunity that exists here, but on the other hand, something that we just have not been very good at. So this is something that I think we need to do, but we don't do very well. And the Trump administration at this point has no monopoly on this. Democrats and Republicans alike have stumbled on these kinds of things. And it's going to continue to happen unless we find a way to make sure that we manage the government the way that, in fact, we want government to be managed. It provides the kind of value to all of us that we as taxpayers deserve.
Got an email from John who says, I think this is a way to decrease the budget. If they consolidate all the money into one, they can explain to people easier how much money is being given. Then they'll more easily be able to cut programs and funding. You touched on that earlier, Don, with concerns about those issues, presumably from Democrats in Congress, the turf war issues you raised. Is this something, when it's released, that you think has a chance of being put into action just in our last 30 seconds or so?
Sure. And the answer is, in the short term, probably not, even though in many ways it's a good idea. But if it goes down, it'll go down mainly because members of Congress are not likely to want to give up their power and their jurisdictions. The conflicts that will be generated on this, the president will discover yet again, are the kinds of things that make for epic battles. And if anything takes it out, it's most likely to be that.
We'll leave it there for now. Don, thanks a lot for joining us today.
So great to be with you, Rob.
It's Don Kettle, professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, academic director of the LBJ Washington Center, former professor at the UW-Madison. We talked to him about President Trump's reported plans to reorganize the federal government that would include a major consolidation of a wide variety of public assistance programs. Malin Mitchell became head of Wisconsin's Firefighters Union the year Scott Walker was elected Wisconsin's governor. He made a name for himself as a fiery speaker during the Capitol protests of 2011. And today he's running to replace Walker as governor. In our ongoing series on the governor's race, Sean Johnson has this profile.
Malin Mitchell was just 33 years old when Scott Walker introduced the bill now known as Act 10 to restrict the bargaining rights of most public sector unions. To hear Mitchell describe it, he didn't have much experience in public speaking. But when tens of thousands of protesters started showing up at the Capitol, Mitchell got his chance.
How are we doing out there? I can't hear you. How are we doing out there?
Mitchell had a knack for reading crowds and feeding off their energy.
And to show you that the firefighters are with you, if there was any doubt, we're going to make sure there is no doubt tonight. Because the firefighters are going to sleep in the Capitol tonight.
Firefighters were exempt from most of Act 10. Just being there a week after the bill was introduced was a show of solidarity. It's not Mitchell's only connection to Walker. They grew up in the same small town, Delavan, and graduated from high school about a decade apart. Kevin Hembrook was one of Mitchell's close friends in high school.
If you could find somebody that didn't like Malin Mitchell in that class, good luck, because I'm pretty sure that he was well-liked by everybody.
Hembrook followed Mitchell to Madison and to firefighting. He remembers watching his friend during the 2011 protests.
I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it again because of the way he would speak and the praise that he would get from the people in the crowd.
Mitchell says he didn't grow up in a union household. He went to culinary school but quit after a year to become a firefighter because his older brother made it sound fun. He says he got more involved in the union after a fellow firefighter in Madison was left paralyzed in an off-duty snowmobile crash. The union raised money for the firefighter and stayed active in his life until he died more than a decade later.
And that's the catalyst that made me get in a union, because I said I would be part of that, part of something that's basically bigger than yourself.
Mitchell has endorsements from the AFL-CIO, Ask Me, and a road building union that endorsed Scott Walker in his first run for governor. But Wisconsin unions are weaker than they were before Walker signed Act 10 and later right to work for private sector unions. James Feigenbaum is an assistant professor of economics at Boston University who has studied how the passage of right-to-work laws affect the power of unions to influence elections. In short, he says the laws leave Democrats worse off with fewer rank-and-file union members to get out the vote.
It would not surprise me at all that sort of a weakened labor movement or weakened organized labor would have a harder time sort of making their endorsements really count.
Mitchell has embraced unions, but says he's not just the labor candidate. In his speeches today, he reminds crowds that they could make history with his candidacy. He'd be Wisconsin's first ever African-American governor. Mitchell has the endorsement of Congresswoman Gwen Moore. She says Democrats have been too cautious in previous campaigns against Walker.
We're always so calculating about this whole, can we find a self-funder? We need somebody with money. Oh, can we find someone who's moderate that can appeal to the people up north?
Moore says this year Democrats should support someone who, quote, has their heart. For her, that's Mitchell.
I need somebody who is on fire. And that was a firefighter.
Mitchell ran an unsuccessful campaign for lieutenant governor in the 2012 recall election. He remembers the exact number of votes he got when he came up short. The recall raised Walker's national profile and dealt a blow to unions. Mitchell wants to return the favor in November. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the U.S. Department of Education is looking at the causes of school shootings and ways to prevent them, but the education secretary says issues of access to firearms will not be on the agenda. We'll get the latest on that story. Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine is back with us for a look at the latest science news, and she's been working on a list of things we maybe all should try to learn about science. She'll share some of what she came up with. And why do we procrastinate? A subject close to my heart. Psychologist Regan Gruing joins us for a look at why it's so easy to put things off and so hard to get stuff done without a deadline. And we'll ask for your stories of procrastination. You can get started right now, actually. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Don't put it off. Are you a procrastinator? Why or why not? That and more, all coming up Monday here on Central Time.